CABU program has been made possible in part by CABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland Underground Graduate School, creating lifelong learning opportunities that work for everyone's real lives. For more information, please visit www.pugspdx.com. And now it's time for Pacific Underground. That's right. There's chops, everyone. Good Hey-o. Morning, afternoon.
Good morning.
It's time for Pacific Underground.
Yay. Is it morning?
It's actually afternoon. Is it? I don't know. I guess it just depends.
It's afternoon in the East Coast.
There you go. I think it kind of depends on like where you think. Like, does afternoon start at 11? Because to me, when I say, hey, meet me in the early afternoon, that means like people can start meeting me at 11.
That means people can start meeting me at 12 at the latest.
Jake, what's your
or
afternoon?
Earliest, I guess.
I usually use noon.
Oh, dang. So I just got to jump on everybody and everyone like thinks I'm weird when I'm like, meet me at 11:30. And they're just like,
but I think
morning.
We've also established, Jenna, you're far more responsible than me.
I just like to think it's like my super Japanese side where like I'm perpetually terrified of being late.
If you're only 5 minutes early, then you're late.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the last Japanese thing I showed up to, I was like, 10 minutes early, but everybody had already been there for a half an hour.
See, that Filipino like... time's different. If I show up 10 minutes late, then I'm kind of early. The and real part doesn't start about half hour.
Island time.
And is everyone looking at you all weird?
Yeah, they're like, why'd you show up so soon?
See, but you don't got stuff to do?
Why'd you bring potato salad?
For me,
I'm super white, though, so.
For me, it's just a personality trait that I'm always just a little bit late. It's just me. It has nothing to do with my Chinese heritage or anything.
Speaking but, of heritage.
Yeah, I was speaking just of about, speaking of our like, respective
what are
API
talk
heritages.
To? Yeah, today's show is not about talking about clocks today and our time.
Is May anything particular
No,
special?
This is the perfect segue.
Well, Jake, I'm so glad you asked. Today, and every day in May, apparently, is Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. Now, this is something that is official. Congress passed the law. And so every year in the month of May, we're supposed to, you know, recognize Asian Pacific American heritage. And for people who are wondering, yes, even the current administration made a proclamation this year. They did on April 30th. They did last year. The proclamation is very well written.
Yeah, no, surprisingly, it must have been by the previous people.
Not written by Trump.
Oh, you just said, I don't know if we need to hit the dump button. You just said the word.
Well, I'm just glad they didn't change it back to Oriental heritage.
It would not have surprised me if they did.
Given some of the dinosaurs and that.
Well, I feel like maybe they still recognized API Heritage, AAPI Heritage Month because it's an extension of whiteness, and Asians are white adjacent, so therefore we will legitimize your month and heritage.
Yeah, we'll get into all that sort of stuff, but let's give people some background, extra in case they don't know much about it, because Asian Americans and Pacific Islander Americans often don't know about this month at all. So whether you are one of those folks or maybe you are Hakushin folks, and you're like, I don't even know this exists. Here we go. So,
I didn't know this month existed until a few years ago.
I don't think you knew this show or the month existed until you joined Pacific Underground.
No, yeah. No, yeah, exactly. I didn't know this was a thing
wow.
until I joined
learning
Pacific
something
Under-
new.
Yep. Learning something new every day.
Yeah, there we go. That's what community radio is for, to teach you stuff. So, this month of May was chosen to commemorate APA history or heritage because the month of May was the month that the first Japanese immigrant came to the United States in 1843. And I don't know if he'd be considered an immigrant. We'll get into that whole story, what that is. But and then it was also the same month that the Transcontinental Railroad was finished in 1869. And, you know, since we know that the vast majority of the workers that worked on the Transcontinental Railroad were Chinese immigrants. They were also from other various Asian nations. And so that month was chosen. Back in 1977, it was proposed as like a week. And over the next couple decades, it was always declared as like a week. And then people tried to extend it to like 10 days. And then eventually in 1992, it finally got declared as an actual month. And so that, you know,
1992.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea.
The process had started in 1977. So, and I got
Bush Senior, I think.
These things are always a surprise. At the same time,
so weird.
Not right.
Yeah.
So, so I guess we should also kind of talk about the APAs here in Oregon. I got some a little bit of the statistics. So, according
actually, before we go into that, tell me, I had no idea that a Japanese person was the first Asian American officially. There was.
You want to know the story?
I'd like to hear about that.
Okay, so this is a story that is really well known in Japan, but is not well known in the United States, even amongst Japanese Americans. They find this story kind of surprising. So, and this is me kind of pulling facts out of my head from what I've been told and a little bit of Googling this morning. So hopefully I get the story right. That there was a shipwreck. Basically, there was a fishing boat in Japan, and it was rescued by an American naval ship. And so this group of like Japanese guys who were being saved, these fishermen were first taken to Hawaii. And so, but Hawaii, you know, was not part of the United States yet. So first they went to Hawaii, and then I guess this one guy, his name was Manjiro, he stayed aboard, and they went from Hawaii, they went around South America, and they went all the way up to Massachusetts.
Wow.
And he got to Massachusetts in 1843. And basically became the first Japanese person to step foot on the mainland of the United States.
Mm.
And so I think it's a kind
1843.
Of 1843. And then he was called, his name is Manjiro, but he was called John. Because, that's what you got to do when you come to the United States.
Right.
Your name
change
can't
your
be,
name.
Oh, you got to hurry up and become a John. So he became.
Sounds more American.
Well, he was called John Mung.
Oh.
By the Hakujin folk that helped take care of him.
Wow.
And then he like went back to Japan, and he was kind of like a celebrated guy because people were like, what's going on in the United States, and what is this? And and so he was like a fisherman. So in Japan, in that time, especially if you're like a fisherman or you're just like a peasant, lower class person, you don't have like a surname that's like that's reserved for the noble class. And so he was allowed to take on a surname.
Mm.
Wow.
Because he was so honored. And so he took on the name Manjiro Nakanohama. And his family is still in Japan, although they go by Nakahama now. And then he came to the United States, and he was just like...
No relation to Ryan. Right.
Maybe. Probably not. Probably not, just because
friend of the show.
Our friend of
Ryan
the show.
Nako.
Yeah, shout out to poet Ryan. He's Okinawan, and John Mung / Manjiro / Nakanohama is actually from my hometown.
What?
That's right. So there's all sorts of pride.
Could
at the same
you
be time like
related
what?
To him?
No. Maybe.
So
I'm just going to declare, I'm going to claim him.
Okay.
No, but at the same time, it's also like kind of cringy. It's like, oh man, you were the first one. Japanese
but
people always doing
why
that.
Why do you think he's, I guess maybe it's partly because Japanese people keep better records and they weren't colonized. Because if you take 1843 compared to the landfall of supposedly the first Filipino immigrants on Morro Bay in San Diego, which is like the 1700s, but there's no records of that, right? Mm. Or St. Malo in Louisiana, it's all just oral history. And
well, it's also privilege too, because as Jenna, you've mentioned on the show, we've mentioned multiple times on the show, not just Jenna, but about East Asian privilege versus Southeast and Pacific Islander privilege. About
Japanese are the only sort of Asians that white people considered human beings at one point.
I think that's still true. Yeah. Still very, very true. Because I hear the way that, you know, China is spoken about and Korea is spoken about and then Japan gets spoken about as if it's like some like haven, some
that's
European
what Columbus
retreat.
Was trying to look for.
Yeah, he was trying to go to Japan. Yeah. If he had gone to Japan 14 whatever, he would have been like,
that's what
well,
Lewis
we
and Clark were
place.
Also looking for. Passages to China, Japan,
like
Korea.
We heard there's some anime here.
Yeah. Oh good, this place is acceptable to me, it's something I understand.
Yeah.
So that's what APA Heritage Month is. It's very much grounded a lot in as a lot of things are in the Asian American movement. There was a lot of Japanese people who were behind the founding of this, you know, Senator Inoue from Hawaii, who, you know, he's Hawaiian and Japanese, was one of the people who really pushed for it to become a month. And so, you know, it really is very representative, I think, of like the Asian American experience and what that is that who are the voices that are being listened to, but then who also is being included under the umbrella of what the label is. And it's so complicated because it's like, okay, I just got to say, I got to state at the beginning of the show, if you're a fan.
Get ready.
Of Pacific Underground, you know that every year when this month comes up, I just got a rant that I hate Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, but I will add a new thing. I hate / love. I've added
what?
To I'm trying to show some
oh
more
my
love.
Gosh, you've you, grown.
Because I got evolved. So much criticism from people being like, do you not believe in the Asian American movement then? And I do. I just don't like the label of Asia.
Okay. Mm.
So before y'all send
we'll get
me
into that.
The angry tweets. Just know.
Also, we don't have a Twitter account, so don't send us angry tweets.
I do, but
oh, okay.
I get all sorts of weird messages. And I understand. I understand.
Don't like, at me.
I understand why people hate on me for hating on APA Heritage Month. But I think I'm like a lot of people who have mixed feelings about these dedicated months. Mm-hmm. You know, because I'm angry that it has to exist at all. Like, I'm not mad that Asians like have band or you know have come together for political power and also you know just to be able to survive in this country, you
right.
know. And so I understand that and I think it's a powerful thing. I just hate the label Asia.
Yeah.
And I hate that the month has to exist, but
that's fair.
Do you
it's better than Oriental though. I
yes.
mean, if we talk about the movement and the history,
much
like,
better than Oriental.
From what I read, I didn't really have a lot of Filipino consciousness or Asian American consciousness growing up, and it wasn't until college that I met with some people that much more, you know, came from much these ethnic enclaves in bigger cities where they had a little bit more breathing space to be human, and you know, kind of taught me about some of these struggles that happened. And yeah, if that's a good segue, I wanted to talk about a little bit about the one that I learned about of sort of kind of Filipino activists.
Ooh,
in
yeah.
Manila Town in San Francisco.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I guess I can play a clip first. That's from this documentary, The Rise of the Eye Hotel, that references a previous documentary by Curtis Choi called The Fall of the Eye Hotel, which he actually carried a camera with him in 1978, when I was just like a baby or whatever, as this final eviction was going on. And tells a little of the background, and we can talk about it after.
Wait, so does the clip set up like what the Eye Hotel is and stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, for people who don't know what Eye Hotel is, it stands for International, which I could rant all day about things that are labeled as international in this country. It's like the big D word, diversity. Ah.
I learned in one of my college classes that the specific color of orange that the Golden Gate Bridge is painted is called International Orange.
Wow.
I bet we could unpack that, and I bet it has something to do with Asians in San Francisco. But so talking about San Francisco, let's hear this clip about the International Hotel there. Here we go.
Starting in the early 1960s, San Francisco redevelopment began to demolish whole neighborhoods, such as the Fillmore District and the South of Market area, moving out thousands of people in its wake and replacing the spaces with high-rises, luxury hotels for the tourist industry, and housing for white-collar professionals. Manila Town, a 10-block area near the financial district that housed a significant Filipino community, stood in the way of this progress. And over the years, the neighborhood had been chipped away until it was reduced to one last block where the International Hotel stood.
That's the noise of, that's the sound of Richard Hangisto swinging a sledgehammer, breaking in a door here at the tenants of the International Hotel.
The sheriff wheels the sledgehammer once again on a locked door. There we go, knock the door open.
Now they come here and Hangisto make a lot of damages to human body, to human right. We're a peaceful people who lives in that building. And why do you have to do this to us?
The demonstrators, the people in support of the International Hotel tenants, have moved into a human barricade surrounding the International Hotel as the scene seems to tense up. It appears as though people are understanding that the police department are about to make their move and are militantly shouting their sentiments about what's going to happen tonight. And you can hear that in the background.
They're hitting people. From the other side, these police units that are on horseback are now moving into the crowd and effectively keeping the crowd on the other side from moving. What's happening is that a large portion of the crowd in front of the door, front door of the International Hotel is being squeezed between officers with clubs on one side and officers on horseback on the other side. Situation is very ugly here at the International Hotel. A large group of supporters massed in front of the front door of the International Hotel are being pushed by force by members of the San Francisco Police Department. They're not moving. The supporters are not moving.
Fight hard with us so that we can maintain the hotel from being demolished. Our unity is our strength, our hope.
Wahat Tampau, born on February 14, 1910, in Pico, La Trinidad Mountain Province in the Philippines, served in the U.S. Navy from 1928 to 1949. He first came to the International Hotel in 1929. Like other sailors and merchant seamen, whenever he was in San Francisco, he stayed at the I Hotel. He made it his permanent home in 1963. His wife and five children stayed in the Philippines, and he sent most of his money home to them.
All right. So that last part was a little bit of background about the gentleman who was speaking with a really thick Filipino accent immediately before that, who was one of the elders and one of the elderly organizers. So you saw it was a mix between old and young that that kind of fought there. And it wasn't just Filipinos. It was a lot of Chinese and Japanese Americans that were angry about kind of the treatment of their elders. And they kind of saw in this a sort of a solidarity movement that they could help support because, you know, the history of Filipinos is like not really, you know, strong imperial history to speak of. You know, mm-hmm. we were colonized by the Spanish and then the Americans. And so like, the whole umbrella movement was kind of necessary for us because people didn't really believe in our struggle until, you know, more privileged Asians spoke up for us, which sucks, but that's just the way it was.
Why were the Filipino, the residents of the International Hotel getting kicked out?
Because San Francisco wanted to redevelop that area that was
quote
previously
unquote, redevelop.
Previously, the kind of enclave of Manila Town that had a lot of restaurants, mm. pool halls, and everything like that, it was considered a slum and considered urban blight and not really, so there was a lot of displacement.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's
every time I think about the title, you know, APA Heritage Month, it's always one of those things where when we talk about the historical things, it always brings up all that frustration of like, oh yeah, this is our heritage in the sense that we constantly carry it forward and we're constantly having to repeatedly do the same struggle, right? Because all the Chinatowns, all the Asia towns, right, in the United States right now are being gentrified. And we see it happening here in Portland.
Chinatown is a joke. The one in downtown Portland. And it's, gentrification happening.
Yeah, Seattle just went through that huge fight. And you see it even happening in New York where you would think, oh, that's not going to happen in New York. It's such a stronghold. But it is, right?
It's totally happening.
And because that's what happens. And it's happening in San Francisco. You know, this isn't the first time it's happening in San Francisco. And it's like we're constantly watching.
It's happening in Seattle.
Yeah, everywhere. You know.
Yeah.
And we're constantly seeing that, right, the most vulnerable amongst us, and it's always the elders.
Yeah.
It's always the elders who are being kicked out of, like, their places. And so it's sad that you can play this clip from 1977, but it's very much what's happening right now.
Yeah, it's really poignant, especially if you're in a culture that values your elders and stuff, to see them, like, kicked out on the street and, like, kind of their dignity and everything. There's so much sort of that we associate with a home and, like, being, you know, having a home and having a community and stuff in this whole community. And a lot of them died after they were basically forced into, you know, being homeless after that.
Yeah.
Wow.
But hey, that neighborhood got redeveloped.
And there is a nice postscript that, like, the lot that on Kearney and Jackson Street in San Francisco was actually bought by a community association and redeveloped as low-income housing for elders with a plaque with all of the, you know, the former residents memorialized on there. And they regularly do kind of cultural events and, you know, there's a little museum in there. And so there's a second clip, if you want to go to that, that's from the dedication of that with a couple of they were previously college students at UC Berkeley in San Francisco State, Emil de Guzman and Nancy Holm, that they're really connected with that struggle. And at the rededication, they had some stuff to say.
When in 1968, the elderly tenants received their first notice of eviction from the Milton Meyer Company in order to demolish the building and build a parking lot, the young generation of the Filipino community, mainly students, was also searching for its identity. Students and young people around the world rebelled in the late 1960s, but for Filipino Americans, that youth rebellion took the form, in part, of coming to the defense of their elders. Youth were looking for answers about their own history and community, and they found their roots in the Manila Town community.
All, you know, all Kearney Street was destroyed, and this was like the last building. And this is why the resistance was more important. It was like that sort of connection was finally made between another generation to the monarch. So they stood up, but it was like another connection was made to a generation of young people who rushed to this, who gravitated to it.
The International Hotel made a contribution to people's movements generally in the United States, but the struggle also profoundly affected the character of an entire ethnic community. The left-oriented elderly joined with the newly radicalized youth to create an identity through political struggle and a coherent, self-conscious narrative of Filipino experience in America took shape.
Years from now, we may wonder if this building, if people will lose the memory of this building and the people who helped build it and the people who helped create the International Hotel. And I just want to say that the memory of this building, everybody who's ever lived in the I Hotel, everybody who's ever sang and read poetry and done music in the International Hotel will never ever be lost. We will always carry this building with us, and this building will always carry our spirit, because this is not an ordinary building. There may be people who will treat it like this and see that it's just a building that houses people, but for us it's more than that. It houses all our dreams and all our ancestors' dreams and their ancestors' dreams, and it goes on into the future. This building is not an ordinary building, and its memory and our connection to it will never ever be lost. I want you to remember that for all time. And this community is always a part of the International Hotel, now and into the future.
What year was that rededication happening?
It was back in 2005.
Oh, wow.
And so it was like a long struggle, 1977 to 2005. It was just a sort of like vacant lot with fence around it that like...
Nice redevelopment.
Nothing was built. And they wanted to build a parking lot or a parking garage, something ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And the community kept fighting. And so, I mean, there's something to be said for the kind of, not giving up.
Yeah, and reclaiming that heritage and that property and land. Well, I did a lot of research into Grace Lee Boggs.
Yeah, Grace Lee Boggs.
Great.
Yeah. Who... she was an Asian American activist who worked mainly in Detroit, which I think is really cool. And
it's not a city you think of,
yeah,
as having many Asian American.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. And also, she died in 2015, but up when she was 100.
Oh my gosh!
And even into her 90s, she was still doing activist work. And what I think is really cool is that she stayed in Detroit when so many people had left after, I think, the decline of Detroit has started happening around the 90s, when a bunch of foreign car makers started selling cars cheaper than American cars, and also a lot of domestic car manufacturers started going overseas, vice versa, to for cheaper labor costs. And there's a great documentary on Netflix right now, a Netflix streaming right now, called American Revolutionary, by another, ironically enough, another filmmaker named Grace Lee, no relation, and
also Chinese,
but also Chinese American woman. And she filmed this one scene in the documentary that was a Q&A between Grace and another Asian American woman. And the woman was asking how you stop yourself from suffering burnout. And I think Grace's advice was so important. And very deep. And
right.
It resonated with me.
That's great. So let's hear that.
I stayed involved because I've stayed in one place for the last 55 years. I think it's because I grew to love Detroit and to feel responsible for Detroit that I was able to grow. And trying one thing after another and trying to learn from everything that I try. That's the only way. I mean, the illusion that there's a quick answer leads to burnout.
Such good advice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I find that advice so true, just like in my own life, where it's hard to, at least for me, it's hard to fight for a cause, but the motivation is much easier when you like ground it in real people, in real location, and focus on like one thing, because mm-hmm. the problems that are happening in one place are probably happening like right everywhere
nationwide.
And it's so exhausting when you try to feel like you're taking on the system wide, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm gonna take on America versus like let's just take on the city council.
Yeah.
But you can still address those same things. Yeah, she mm-hmm. knew how to do that.
She was mm-hmm. super inspirational.
Yeah, yeah. We watched it, all the three of us watched it together last night. And
we did a little Grace Lee Boggs refresher.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because every once in a while, you also just got to hear the voice of the elders.
Yeah.
To be reminded, like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I also liked her attitude about just how calm she was about everything and how she took everything in the long view and how she understood that change doesn't come right away. You do have to keep working at it. And maybe you won't see change in your lifetime, but you'll inspire a younger generation to keep going. And her advice about not suffering from burnout resonated with me because I love Portland and I really want to see Portland not so white. I feel like even though it's hard for POC people in Portland, I shouldn't have to leave. I was born and raised here. Why should I have to leave? Like, people, like, a bunch of transplants. I'm not saying transplants should leave, but
they should.
I know.
They should respect the people.
They should have a respect for people that were born and raised here and their perspectives and their experiences and how you can't just come into a place and co-opt the culture, co-opt the people, raise the rents for people that were born or raised here and made the neighborhoods and the culture that what you want, that is what attracted you to Portland.
I'm sure there are many groups of people across the United States who feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So one thing I really liked about that documentary was that, you know, they did talk to her about what it was like to suddenly be, like, identified with the Asian American movement later in her life, because she wasn't involved with the Asian American movement. Mm. She was involved with the civil rights movement, and she very much, all her work was with the Black community and through Black struggle. And then all of a sudden later in her life, when the second wave Asian American movement came about,
then she was identified with the Asian American movement. And it was funny, in the documentary she talks about when she was suddenly identified with that, and she said, I never really thought of myself as Asian American. And there's an FBI file on her because she was also involved in Marxist left-leaning communist movements.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, no. Not the commies.
Oh, no, not the commies.
And she was, in one file, she was identified as Afro-Chinese. And,
oh, wow.
I thought it was also interesting to hear a few of the African-American leaders at the time, civil rights leaders, that we didn't think of her as Chinese. And they didn't really think of her as African either. She was just Grace.
Yeah. Angela Davis gave her, like, a major kind of,
like, major prop.
And I was like, wow. Yeah.
You know, because it's really interesting to see, you know, that second wave Asian American movement, which I think we're, like, still in right now. Or maybe we're on a...
Maybe we're third?
Maybe third?
I don't know.
Who knows? It's so
I
many...
consider the 90s second wave.
So then are we in a third wave? We'll discuss that. Know. That's a whole other show. But that, you know, you have these, like, so many Asian Americans who are trying to find identity and to find the people who took radical enough action to cause change and stuff and to understand intersectionality, you know, and they're going back to the elders like Grace Lee Boggs and Yuri Kochiyama, you know, who are like these two really big figures from that era and who are two people who were not heavily involved in the Asian American movement. And like, I just find that really fascinating.
I like to pretend in my head that Yuri and Grace met up for tea every weekend.
Yeah. No, they were totally best friends. They were totally texting each other all the time.
Yeah.
And like sharing notes.
Emailing.
Writing letters.
Yeah.
Writing letters, just being like, what's going on here? Oh my God, we're on t-shirts. Oh my God.
I want Kanan's Oh My Boggs quote to be on t-shirts.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not familiar with
this. I forgot about Oh My Boss.
There was one episode where...
Of Pacific Underground?
Yeah, Pacific Underground, where...
take it back to the archives.
Yes. So if you would like to listen to that quote, it's one of our past episodes where a collective member, Kanan, use the expression "Oh my Boggs" in response to something else. I can't remember the exact context, but you can all listen to our past shows and then you can tell me.
Yeah, try not to actually use that expression in life. But so we got Grace Lee Boggs. You know, there's unfortunately, as Asian Americans, we're not taught our history much.
I didn't know about this woman.
No, we're not taught about it in school. You often have to take Asian American history, or you have to join, like, you know, API Affinity Club or stuff like that, just to, like, learn about these people, especially because they're always considered, quote unquote, like, controversial because of, like, who they were associated with. And so that part of our history often gets erased. And so, yeah, that's why it's good to talk about it for API Heritage Month, because they are a part of our heritage. Even if they weren't largely part of the Asian American movement, they have largely influenced how the Asian American movement now tries to work itself. Because one thing I loved with Yuri Kochiyama, because I'm always like fangirling her, but when Japanese people got reparations, you know, somebody had asked her, like, okay, well, you know, what's next? What's next for your people? And her answer was, well, reparations for Black people. Hmm. And, you know, she was one of the very, I want to say few, but that type of discussion, that it's like, hey, these things aren't just about us, and they shouldn't end at us, and maybe they shouldn't even be starting with us. You know, it's, I appreciate the elders who were willing to constantly push that conversation about, like, where is the heart of systemic oppression, and it's not with us. Right. So yay, Grace Lee Boggs. We should take a quick break. By the way, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Pacific Underground here on KBOO Community Radio. We're talking about Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. And in that vein of really powerful femmes speaking out about what is oppression and what is that experience, I'm going to give a shout out to Ruby Ibarra, because we love Ruby Ibarra. We've played her music on our show before. We had
Filipino American
out of the Bay Area. And right now in Asian America, her song Us is blowing up, and the video is powerful and amazing. One thing, though, that she also does, if you follow her YouTube, is she does a lot of spoken word. And so I'm going to have a clip here. Let's pull this one up of Ruby Ibarra doing some spoken word about hate and and that experience. She recorded this while she was in the Philippines a couple years ago.
There is a word that my five-year-old niece doesn't know exists. It's something she doesn't battle with, and it's never escaped her lips. It's a four-letter, one-syllable, simple word, hate. Yet it carries so much historical, political, emotional weight that shaped our beliefs, changed what we see, and made us envy. It's made us blind to truth, defiant excuse, caused lies and abuse, so our minds can't choose, designed so we lose. Lose control of reality, lose trust, and lose ourselves. Like poisonous gas that wraps around our lungs so we can't breathe or yell for help. So she asks me, what is hate? It's made men turn on each other, cock the gun and hold at gunpoint. It's made scapegoats so we blame folks for our faults while our fingers point. It's made innocent lives grow closed eyes while enclosed a mask of lies, by making teenage girls cry because their body size will never suit your eyes. It's made us wish we were someone else. Forces of the plastic surgery, so erasing cultural history and urge of ideal imagery, our burglar row and identity. It's tricked us into believing that we're too fat, too ugly, and not white enough. Racially profiles have forced people to sit in the back of the bus. It's made men call women bitches, who in turn call other women bitches. It's burned bridges to the point where they don't know which is wrong or right. It's made us colorblind, only seeing black and white. Planting racism and bigotry, promoting racial tensions and fights. Again, she asks me, what is hate? It's taught 18-year-old boys how to use a gun while in the same field stands 5-year-old children who are taught to shoot someone. It's made victims of abusive fathers do the same to their own daughters. It's made men boost their masculinity by exploiting another's femininity. It's built glass ceilings, internment camps, nooses, and not allowed signs. It's raised narrow-minded babies so maybe they'll never see past their own kind. It controls the schools, the media, through propaganda, teaching us the enemy when we don't question or raise our hand up. Still, she asks me, what is hate? It's caused school shootings, injustice, rape, and genocide. It's made innocent lives die and innocent mothers and wives cry. It screams the words, fuck you, bitch, stupid, and no homo. It's a KKK logo. It's a history book's photo. It's written Jim Crow laws, ending and removal, and the Asian Exclusion Acts. It's enslaved our past, one graves a cage in our path. It's made categories of fears appear, making us wish for another extent, making us live to clean the mirrors, buying an interference 500 years of slavery when oppression, parents failing to give their children direction. It's confessions behind closed doors of elections the politicians never mention. It's literacy prevention of Filipino veteran offension, stereotypes when dimension, character inventions, all being but white supremacy's erection. So what is hate? It's something that my five-year-old niece can't feel. For her, it's a man-made social construct, so it isn't real. It's an empty word, insignificant, powerless, and nameless. Now I'm just waiting for the rest of the world to follow, so we don't know what hate is. Let's no longer know what hate is. Ruby Ibarra, bow.
Ooh,
right?
Dang.
Yeah, and like, I just really appreciate what she does. You know, she right now, not only does she have that amazing video for us, she, because she's like the busiest woman in America, probably, you know, she just brought out a documentary that she made and just premiered at CamFest. And so, I mean, it's just like, this is what I think of when I think of kind of third, fourth wave, whatever we are in right now of the Asian American movement. It's so much about people reclaiming the identity and speaking out, and, you know, so much of being labeled Asian or API, we're always thought of as being, you know, the quiet, calm people who don't fight
model
back.
Minority.
You know, right, the model minority. So if you are the kind of people who are willing to speak up, show anger, even use words like hate, that is something still radical and revolutionary, often within the Asian American community. So just to see someone doing the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even
making
though
the documentary,
I need
doing
to replay that at like half speed because her flow is so fast.
Yeah, no, it's definitely check it out on the YouTube, man. Because I think she's helping us, the rest of us who have like a slower era, because you can see she has it's really awesome. She has like all the words, pop up.
Yeah. Oh, good.
So yeah, because I definitely had to listen to that a couple times. Like, I heard about half that the first time. I wish I could spit things that fast. I wish I could. That's some talent right there. So,
be more efficient with your time.
Yeah. Just talk really fast.
Yeah, but just, you know, I feel like so much of how we see a lot of activism and on how a lot of voices are being presented these days is so much through people creating their own media. That's what's so awesome about the movement right now is, like, we don't have to wait for people to interview us and stuff. We just, like, YouTube it. Have your own social media, like, have your own voice. And she's definitely, she is killing it. So go, Ruby.
Everyone, if you ever want to talk to us, give us a call.
Love to have you on the show.
We're totally fangirling on you right now, Ruby. Yeah.
And fanboy.
Yeah. We're just, come on our show. We love you.
Email us.
Yeah. Give our number. Give out the cell phone number.
Yeah.
Go on a road trip to San Francisco. Just yeah. Like, we invited you onto our show. You never called us from that one episode, so we just weren't coming down to you.
Yeah.
You can Skype us.
Also, another thing we have coming up for you is...
Speaking of Filipino femmes.
Yeah, Kat, collective member of Kat Patuigas, she wasn't able to be here this morning, so she did this awesome segment for us. So let's take a listen to what Kat has for us.
Take it away, Kat.
Hey, it's Kat, one of the producers for this show. For this Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I thought I'd shine a spotlight on Gina Rosero. Gina is a Filipino American fashion model and activist. She's been featured on the covers and pages of Glamour Magazine, Harper's Bazaar, Vanity Fair, to name just a couple, no big deal. And she's also spoken at the UN and the White House, also not a big deal at all. Gina identifies as a trans woman. She first came out as trans at a TED Talk that she gave in 2014. So by then, Gina had already become an American citizen after emigrating from the Philippines as a teenager. And at that point, she'd already been working for years as a model. So after having to keep her identity and story a secret for so long, from most people, like her employers, neighbors, even friends. She finally decided that she couldn't live that way anymore. If you'd like to listen to Gina's TED Talk in its entirety, it's available on the website www.ted.com, and the name of the talk is Why I Must Come Out. It's heartfelt, it's inspiring, and it's really no more than 10 minutes, I think, so I really recommend watching it. We'll also make sure to include a link to the TED Talk in our show page on the KBOO website. So, as Gina points out in her TED Talk, gender fluidity has occupied a place in Asian communities throughout history. In the Philippines in particular, LGBT plus communities have had to live, and definitely continue to live, interesting, but also extremely challenging experiences. On one hand, this could be characterized by tolerance, if you will, and some would say acceptance. Gina's start was at a beauty pageant for trans women, and these events are actually pretty popular and well-attended. Gender non-conforming individuals are prominent in media, in politics, and in business. The first openly transgender woman in Philippine Congress was elected a couple years ago in 2016. So, on a number of levels, people are open to it. Although there's definitely critiques to be made and a lot to unpack about the nature of the visibility of trans and gender nonconforming folks in the country. On the other hand, the level of education about trans communities and gender nonconformity in general is still lacking in many ways. The country is still struggling to officially recognize and institutionalize LGBT rights on a national level. For one, trans people can't change their gender as put down on their birth certificate, their quote-unquote legal gender, which is what had actually prompted Gina to migrate to the U.S. so many years ago. In the Philippines, and in the U.S. for sure, trans women, especially trans women of color, are still so much more likely to be victims of discrimination and crime. In many cases, it results in violence and death. In fact, in 2014, the same year that Gina was on stage at TED, one of the biggest news stories from later that year was the murder of Jennifer Laude in Olongapo City in the Philippines by a visiting U.S. Marine. The U.S. Marine did not know that Jennifer was trans and used violence on her when he found out. And this is not a unique and out-of-this-world story by any means. It's the reality that so many trans people live every day. Gina shared her story on TED in commemoration of the International Transgender Day of Visibility. She lists Laverne Cox, Marsha P. Johnson, and Sylvia Rivera as some of the individuals who have inspired her on her journey. And this is also something that I wanted to highlight. As Filipinos, or as Asians here in the United States, we've been privileged enough to have had Black and Brown femmes pave the way before us, so we could also be here to do the work that we're doing now. And it's not just about giving credit. That's obviously important, but what's also really key is that we lift up and stand in and fight for Black and Brown femmes too. Gina is now immersed full-time in advocacy work. After the TED Talk, she launched Gender Proud, a global campaign for transgender rights, and part of what Gender Proud does is that they're also a production company. They're a trans-focused and trans-specific production company. They've partnered with other organizations and companies such as Fusion and Univision to increase trans visibility and awareness. Gina was also executive producer for Logo TV's show, Beautiful As I Want to Be, a web series focusing on and empowering trans youth. Gina and Gender Proud's work has gained recognition by the GLAAD, G-L-A-A-D, Media Awards, and the LGBT Community Center Trailblazer Awards. You can find out more about Gina Rosero and her work at genderproud.com. And that's it for me. Here's to a good rest of the month of May for everyone.
Well, thank you, Kat.
Hey, Kat. Yeah, there's so much going on these days. I'm so excited by all the different voices we hear going on through all the different mediums, TED Talks.
Mm-hmm. The Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, that people can get their voices out and reclaim their heritage.
I know, and speak about topics that are even, you know, that are difficult within the API community. And it's like, why are these topics difficult? Because white supremacy. So in our last few minutes here we have on the show, I'm curious to know, you know, as we're talking about heritage, there's definitely the, you know, the bigger heritage that we all have. What are we as individuals here in this room doing to reclaim heritage, you know, because so much of Asian American history is about erasure and so much about, well, what APA History Month is, literally, it's trying to reclaim that narrative and how do we not get erased. So, Jake, what do you do, like, in your active everyday sort of life to feel like you're reclaiming your heritage?
Well, one of the things is I come on this show and I produce,
became a collective member,
produce clips and help educate myself and unpack some of the sort of shame I had under white supremacy of erasing my Filipino heritage, and try to, you know, like, I can't change what was done in the past, but I can try to reclaim that and kind of project, you know, something different for the future. And another thing is I host a monthly reading series for writers of color with another Asian American friend, Ryan Nakano, friend of the show. And we've got a couple events coming up that are going to be pretty exciting tonight and on June 15th. And the one tonight has a great lineup of six API artists and writers that we're going to be talking about Asian Pacific American Heritage Month and just our own kind of stories and reclaiming that space there. So we've got Anna Vo, Ami Patel, Ken Yoshikawa, Rosminda Nabet, Lillian Drebis, and Alex Chu.
So many people who have been on Pacific Underground.
Many friends of the show.
I think it shows how intimate our API community is here in Portland.
And small.
Yeah, so you're doing things.
Portland's so white.
So I hear that, like, you know, part of your approach is to help give voice to others. That's cool.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jake, for giving a voice to the community. Tabitha, what about you? What do you do?
This show, Pacific Underground, has definitely taught me so much about the Asian American movement. I grew up very assimilated, and all my elder models were also very assimilated. They aspired to be white. And there was a time in my life where I played into those model minority stereotypes. And I tried very hard to be submissive, to be good at math, good at reading, and just excel as a student, but that was never quite me. And as I've learned so much about all these Asian American leaders and Pacific Underground helping me to unpack and examine my upbringing, my identity, and who I am as a person, I've realize that, no, I don't need to do that because I'm Asian. I can just enjoy certain things because I like it, or or examine how performative race is, and how damaging white supremacy has been on me and my community.
That's good, Tabitha. What about you, Jenna? What do you do?
I do a lot of little things that I kind of hope add up. Like, one thing I've definitely tried to do within the last, like, couple years, or especially since moving to Portland, is as a Japanese person, we're always really hung up on being the model minority and being, like, super assimilated and to, like, not identify ourselves as being Japanese. You know, it's a cultural thing because people in Japan are like, you're not Japanese, you live in America. And for a long time, I think I felt, like, really rejected by Japan, and then I didn't know how to feel American. And so in the last few years, I've become very comfortable and okay with the fact that Japanese American is its own culture and its own thing. And it's okay to, like, embrace that and even try to help shape that and, like, what that is. And so I've always really, like, when I was younger, I stepped back a lot from the Japanese American community. I was intimidated by it. And now I'm realizing, like, oh, I can have this kind of be my identity. Like, I can be this thing that only exists in America called Japanese American, where we barely speak Japanese, but we do super Japanesey things, right? So it's difficult, but I think it's, like, reclaiming those little things that have been taken away from us. And, like, one thing I'm trying to do this year, let's see if I can do it, you guys have to, like, help me, is get over my hang-up about changing my name. We'll see if I can do it. Because I would like to go by my Japanese name. I really don't like my English name. But I don't
What's your Japanese name?
Rika. But I don't like how Americans pronounce it, because they go, Rika. Hey, Rika. And so it doesn't sound like they're saying my name to me. And so I've thought about changing it to, like, a different Japanese name that's easier to pronounce. But I don't know. I always go back and forth.
Oh, why do you have to play into the white people, though?
I don't necessarily. It's not about, like, wanting to appease white people. It's just my own uncomfortableness with having to hear my name constantly not being pronounced correctly. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens this year. So you guys help me with that, because I got a lot of hang-ups about it.
All right. I'll do what I can.
Okay. I'll gladly call you Rika if you want me to.
I see. I'm still like, ah. Yeah, see, there we go. There's my hang-up. Yeah, thank you, Tabitha. Thank you, Tabitha, lifting me up. So, well, you've been tuned into another episode of Pacific Underground here on KBOO Community Radio. Make sure to tune in next week, where we're going to be on at 9 a.m. That first Fridays we're always on. And you can check us out always on KBOO.FM. Just search for Pacific Underground. You can always find us on Facebook and the socials at PAC Underground. Oh,
we have an Instagram.
We started our Instagram this week. Wow, we finally caught up. So go ahead, search for us at PAC Underground. We have one whole picture uploaded.
Two.
We're winning, y'all. We're figuring this technology thing out. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk to you in a week.
Sing a song for ourselves. What have we got to lose? Sing a song for ourselves. We got the right to choose. We got the right to choose. We got the right to choose. Foster children of the Pepsi generation, cowboys and Indians ride, red men ride. Hey, watching war movies with the next door neighbor, secretly rooting for the other side. Sing a song for ourselves. What have we got to lose? Sing a song for ourselves. We got the right to choose. We got the right to choose. We got the right to choose. We are the cousins of the freedom fighter. brothers and sisters all around the world. We are a part of the third world people who will leave their stamp on America.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of